I brought your artist file here, and I wanted to just also reiterate what Sarah said, that your artist file is actually a really, really important part of our collection. And it's something that we show as Artechs. We really try to make contemporary art something that's accessible for people, mm-hmm. and something that people can, you know, they don't need a master's degree to understand, right. something that really speaks to people. And so it's something that has been really inspiring to a lot
opener.
Of people. Yeah, so it's for us, it's really, really an honor to have you here.
Oh, great.
And we're happy and excited. Woo-hoo. So, thank you so much for your time and for talking to us.
Well, thanks for your interest, because, you know, in my local community, they're all painters.
Oh, okay.
A few sculptors in there, I suppose, but mm-hmm. So my work is you know, they don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's fine. You know, I don't expect a small town place to do that interesting. So it's great to know that somewhere my work is inspiring people.
Very much so. And for us also, mail art has been a huge, important part of our collection and a lot of our activities and things. And so it's something that we're really trying to also make a place for in our collection.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important to us.
Great.
So I wanted to also just kind of go through your file mm-hmm. with you. So we have in it, we have publications. We also have, this retrospective, 45 years of fooling around.
Yeah, that was that. I mean, the show was amazing to me, and the catalog. I just had no idea that they would produce this book. I mean, she really did a fantastic job. Have you ever met Michelle?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, she was an inspiration in herself. What she was interested in. Early banana rags. What's the date on that? September 87.
87. Yeah.
Yeah. The first ones, I don't know if you've got the first ones, but they were all hand lettered, and you do. These ones here.
We have these first ones here,
When I was the town fool of Victoria.
Yeah, so the town fool, for what I understand, was one of your earliest projects.
Yep.
Yeah, and so how did that project come about?
Well, I remember that we had a fool in Vancouver whose name was Joachim Foikas, and he was only did it for 1 year. But I had come back from, I'd been living at Esalen, and I came back to Victoria, and I wanted to, how do I, you know, connect with the community? And of course, what I chose to do was rather unusual, because but I knew that Vancouver had this guy who did it for a year, Joachim Foikas was his name. I don't know where he came from and where he disappeared to, but it was like, oh, town fool. That sounds about right. And because of the banana, which is also humorous, you know, mm-hmm. involved in many humorous things, it just seemed like the perfect venue. And my background, I don't know how far back we go, but before I went bananas, mm-hmm. I was a teacher.
Okay.
I taught in the elementary school, so 2 years in Vancouver's elementary school, and two and a half years at a private school called, what did we call it? It was a parent-owned co-op, the new school, and I was a teacher there, and in the middle of the third year, it got crazy, because the really young kids were kept in the kindergarten area, and the teacher had control, but the older kids, it just went wild. Mm-hmm. And the third year that I was there, Tom Dury became the director, and he did nothing. He'd sit in the front hall and he'd wait for the kids. The boys in my class, called the Monkey Patrol, came to him and say, hey Tom, let's go so and so. And he'd go off from the school mm-hmm. with these four or five kids without telling anybody. And I know he took them with him when he went to shop things, and the kids came back and showed me things they'd shoplifted.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, it was, So I challenged him, and we, as a parent co-op, we had a meeting, mm-hmm. and I explained what my position was, and I said, I think this is irresponsible, but this is the way that this teacher is approaching it, and I think the kids are learning, getting the wrong message.
Mm-hmm.
And so over, you know, various meetings and teeth gnashings and all of that, he was asked to depart. So he left the school with something like 10 or 11 kids that the parents thought he was like the bright light. Mm-hmm. And so off they went somewhere to one of the Gulf Islands, I think. And then in the remainder of that year, things kind of got more under control. I was able to bring the kids back and get them into projects and so on. Eventually, I left for the States. I went to visit my mail art people.
Yeah.
I went on the road. I had a Dodge van that I could live in, which was shaped after, there was another art on the road artist called Dana Atchley, whose thing was called A Space Company.
Yes, okay.
And he had a Dodge van, the same model as mine, and so I was able to see how he had built a livable space in it, and had mine built with adjustments to using his basic plan, but you know, raising the bed or, you know, doing different, slightly different things. And then I went on the road to visit my mail art people and see where I was going to live next.
Okay, and was this in San Francisco?
This was in Vancouver. That's
okay.
Where I started from.
Okay.
And then I did go down the coast and visited mail artists in Seattle and Oregon.
Okay.
And then I got to San Francisco and it was like, whoa, this is it. But I didn't, I stayed for a while and got to meet with everybody. And that, but I thought, well, I want to, I had a plan. So I went on down to Los Angeles and visited. Lowell Darling was the main person there, but there were several other mail art people. I went to Phoenix and Albuquerque, and the people in Albuquerque said, and I was going to go to Gerdon, Arkansas, where Buzz Blur is, and the people in Albuquerque went, we're not comfortable with you living in your van on the side of the road, that you might end up being murdered and having your van stolen. Like, this is, you're going into, you know, nobody knows where you are. We really don't think it's safe for you to do this. So I listened, and instead of going to Arkansas to meet Buzz Blur, who I've met since, of course, I headed back, and I went up to Crested Butte and visited with Dana Atchley, whose van I had modeled mine after.
Okay.
And then from there, I cleared signals with the people in San Francisco that I could come and stay there, and I ended up getting together with Bill Gaglione.
Okay.
And that was, you know, so I stayed there for maybe 5 years. I'd have to set it with a calendar and so on to,
yeah.
But got totally involved with the Bay Area Dadaists and doing public events and performances.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stayed, and Bill and I, in the later years, we did a tour of Europe that I set up again through the mail art people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm the writer,
yeah.
And he was sort of the mail counterpart that sort of took, like, to take credit for what I did, but was, you know, we had that relationship.
Yeah.
So then Europe was all again based on visiting mail art people, and that one is documented in, you
yes.
probably know which one, I think it might be in this one,
mm-hmm.
the whole
yeah.
European tour.
Mm-hmm.
And again, set up with all of the mail art people, even getting up to Moscow and Budapest.
Okay.
I mean, it was, it, you know, when I look at it now, I think, wow, that was really ambitious what I did to set all that up and be able to pull it off.
Yeah.
And people were so welcoming. In Warsaw, they showed us a building that said Gallery Raymond, and it means galleries closed or something like that. But we did performances in each of the places. I think, I forget how many cities we did, but a lot of all around. Starting, where did we start? I think we started in London with the London Data Group and came over to the coast. I can't remember it. It's all in there anyway. But we did visit all these mail art people. And so it was a connection that, because we had both been mailing to all these people, we had a basis for you know, mutual interests.
Mm-hmm.
And so after Moscow, we went to, forget the name, then into Eastern Europe, until Budapest, where there were soldiers in the streets, and they were quite concerned that, you know, we keep a low profile, the people in the gallery there.
Yeah.
The Galantais, I imagine you might recognize that name, Georgi and Julia Galantai,
okay.
And they had a gallery, and I think their archive went into the National Museum at some point along the line. So
what was it like for you to meet all these people, this network of people that you had been corresponding with?
It was fabulous.
Yeah.
Again, because we had a common interest,
yeah.
We had a basis for conversation. It wasn't like going somewhere and saying, like, not knowing anything about them, or them not knowing anything about us.
Mm-hmm.
And I went with Bill to Budapest, but I also did one or two European tours on my own, and I went back to Budapest as Dr. Anna Freud Banana when I was doing that, you know, wearing my white lab coat and doing my research projects. And the Galantais, I think they eventually, their archive went into the National Museum.
Okay.
And I don't know how, if they lost control of it or whether they still were, you know, engaged with it, but under the employ, but into, like, when they started it, it was an independent venture, which in Budapest, in the Eastern European countries, there's a lot more government control over things. So they, and I've been there, as I say, with Bill, but also on my own a couple of times. And I don't know if I'll ever do that again.
Yeah.
It was a, you know, they were big trips, but it was so fantastic to, you know, go and meet all these people and see their living conditions and the kind of control issues that they had. It was it was just, it was very gratifying, you know, because it establishes a common bond, even though our backgrounds and our political situation is completely different.
Yeah.
But it's the human interest and the fact that we are being able to make these communications.
Yeah.
So.
I wanted to ask you about the aspect of interactivity in your work. I was reading in the essay in the book, 45 Years of Fooling Around, and you say that your work isn't about making things, but making things happen. And so I wanted to just, if you could talk about how it's shaped your work, and also how, what has been also sort of your audience's reaction to your work? And have you had different kinds of reactions to your public interventions? And
for sure, for sure. But the thing is that the public interventions, it's all about engaging other people in the creative act rather than having them watch the creation and stand back and, like, you know, be keep their hands tied and, you know. So, and I think this all comes from my teaching background, is the idea of engagement rather than here am I, here's the show, and you're there, and you stay there. Mine is all about here's the activity that and the challenges, like with the Banana Olympics, you have, it's a performance event. So there's all these races, and you sign up for the races, and you do whatever crazy way of performing the race, as opposed to trying to get across the finish line first. So it's an emphasis on a different set of values, and also about everyone is creative, but we mostly suppress our creativity. Oh, I couldn't do that. I'm not an artist. And yes, you are an artist. You're the artist of your life. And why don't you like loosen up and express your creativity, but we're so indoctrinated, really, by to not express our creativity, to be in awe of those who do, you know, the stars, but we forget about our own star, and we're all stars, we're all living consciousness, and so that's, and it, as I say, I think that comes out of my, why I wanted to be a teacher, to encourage that, people to express their creativity rather than to only be consumers of it and, you know, watchers. Oh yes, we saw that. Well, we want you in it.
Yes, exactly, like to take part, engage. Of just like in consume art. Because it puts an emphasis on the process rather than finished product.
That's right. That's right. So that's where, that's my basic impulse for all of what I do in terms of, and this is about documenting. I love this, this is my daughter's whole little, her drawings, I mean, she was into horses, as you might guess. And so this was her way of using that rubber stamp. I thought that was brilliant. So I published it.
I mean, your publishing practice and your performance and the publishing is sort of, is that as documentation, but also do you see it also publishing as a way of sort of continuing a conversation in a public sphere?
Absolutely.
As a form of engagement and performance.
Yeah, hopefully that people will get, oh, we could do that.
Yeah.
You know, that it's not, I mean, I publish these things to honor the people that sent me whatever it is that I've published of theirs, because it's an acknowledgement and a verification of the, how much I value what I have received, but it's also a way of spurring others to, them and others to participate rather than just be, oh, in awe, you know, and that, then I, you know, awe is a little awful because it usually inhibits the individual who's in awe, like, oh, I couldn't do that.
Yeah, it prevents them from really engaging.
That's right. Yeah. And so my impulse always has been to get them there one way or another. So that's my bottom line. And the banana is just a convenient, well-known tool, which is used by monkeys and apes and so on. So there's always that comedic, you know, in slipping on the banana peel, there's a lot of already preconceived things that you can bounce off of from bananas. And of course it's phallic, which, you know, oh, really? So, you know, it has a lot to going for it, and it serves my purpose.
There's also, well, there's also, it seems like an element like of silliness ingrained in it too. About
absolutely. Yeah. Well, there's lots of comedians have used the banana as well, slipping on the banana peel, for example. Maybe Charlie Chaplin did it, I don't know, but yeah, and they're phallic and that therefore funny. You know, I mean, part of the reason that the phallus is so underexposed in a way, but we have the banana standing in. And oh, is it felt, you know, like, of course they're bananas, they're fruit, they're, you know, it's food. It's not about penises, however, there's the subliminal aspect.
Yeah, there's a lot of different layers there.
Yes. Peel the banana. What do you get? More.
I wanted to ask you just specifically about male art, because I know you've been doing it for a long time, but how do you see, in a way, like, do you see male art differently now and with changing technologies, and do you think the nature of the network has changed?
I think the network is disengaging. It's, first of all, I think the biggest thing that's affecting it is the cost of postage that has gone up so much. And there may be a been there, done that kind of aspect to it as well. And of course, Ray Johnson, who's known as the father of, and I will honor that because he was the one who started sending things to people, you know, that were provocative and sort of off the wall to get people to react. I don't know that he had quite, I did meet him a couple of times, but he's very sheltered, and like he didn't want to stay in, like when I was in New York, he lived on the island, so he didn't stick around for a lot of things, and he wasn't very forthcoming about his motivation, but it was, to me it was similar in that he would send these sort of provocative mailings to people and challenge them in a way to respond, whether they did or not I never had a chance to find out, but I certainly did respond, as did many. Like, now he's like God, now that he's dead, and people are, you know, keeping their collections of Ray Johnson as the, you know, like the money in the bank sort of thing, I think. I mean, I haven't thrown any of it. I don't throw anybody's, unless they do overtly sexual pornographic things, and I've sent things back to people and say, if you want me to respond in future, keep that on some other plane. I'm not interested, because because of the banana, it's obvious that there's the phallic symbol, and people, you know, sort of think, oh, we know about her, you know, and they don't. Those who go that route, and I make it fairly plain. I understand the relationship, or the, you know, the how the banana and the penis become connected, but it's not what I'm exploiting about them. Although I'm aware that it's a subliminal level of the banana.
Do you find that it's kind of also just ironic in a way that Ray Johnson is put on this pedestal now, and having his work as like such precious objects, when male art is something that's meant to be exchanged and you know, as part of a process and communication, but now these works, I mean, I have seen works, you know, sold on eBay for like hundreds of dollars, and that now they have become this precious art
object
that they were trying to go against at the time.
Yeah, no, I find it quite ironic, but it seems to be human nature to exploit, first of all, to engage, and then once that sort of phase is over, oh, well, and I mean, I've kept all of Ray's, but I've kept the only things I've ever thrown out were pornographic stuff that I find offensive.
Yeah.
And aside from that, I've kept everything that Ray sent, which isn't a huge amount, but here's a funny thing. When I told you that Michael and Vincent were, or at least Vincent was up on the coast, and he came finally to have a look at my archive. So we're upstairs in my studio, and I show him this and that, and I said, well, then a lot of the correspondence is downstairs in alphabetized boxes, so okay, he wants to look at the J box, and the first thing and only thing he goes to look at is what I have of Ray Johnson's, and he takes pictures of them. And I thought, right, it's the hero again, you know, the leader. And I, that doesn't mean I don't honor Ray's work. It's just that he was the initiator of this whole process, which is a fantastic thing, but he's not the only one, and it's not necessarily because this particular piece is precious. Now it's because it's Ray Johnson, and of course I responded to all of that, but you know, I thought this is interesting because I have been basically ignored in terms of in the Vancouver scene, like I told you that Michael and Vincent's stuff is at UBC's Belkin, right?
Yes.
And Scott has been very standoffish and not interested. And at this launch, Vincent took me to Scott and introduces, which I already knew, and I think Scott probably was quite well aware of who I was as well. But Vincent is now encouraging Scott to look at my collection, thinking about the Belkin.
So Scott is at the Belkin, Morrison Cohen Belkin Gallery?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
He's the curator of the Belkin Gallery.
Okay.
So I thought that was kind of interesting, but this fact that, you know, Vincent, of, you know, four shelvings of four boxes each, layer alphabetically organized, and the only one he wants to look at is the famous one, the starter. And I thought, you know, this is hierarchical rather than horizontal, which is much more the direction I like to go.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious also just about your thoughts in general about archiving male art, because I've also just in different perspectives of, do you think that it's something that is important to archive, or is it something that's also ephemeral, and how does the nature of how we read the works change when we look at, because when we do look at it in an archive, no matter what, we attribute like this preciousness to it.
Yeah.
When it was something that was like exchanged and part of a correspondence.
Yeah, it's ironic.
Yeah.
Is the bottom line is it's an ironic transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in, you know, if you took it out of the art context and you say look at family albums or that sort of thing, we take pictures in order to preserve the memory of this person or that thing at the time. And at the time, you know, we still kind of value them because, you know, this is my family or these are my friends or whatever. But then over the years, they gain a kind of, well, it then gives us the history of the family. And when it's the family album, like I've just recently went through the family album I prepared for my daughter, and I went, ooh, this is really neat, you know, because it goes back to my parents' parents and that sort of thing up into the present. So it seems to me that it's a human trait to want to keep a record of, you know, of whatever it is, like the growth of the family, the perpetuation of the family. And I guess in a way that's the same applies with the male art.
Mm-hmm.
And when it becomes valuable is, I suppose, once I'm dead, like once Ray's dead, the price, you know, the value of his works escalates, and of course he was in New York, he was well known in the city and so on. So I think the same applies, and whether, like, I value what I have received from everybody, and I value it because of the connection that it made and the opportunity to know that person and their creativity, not so much as a monetary value.
Yeah.
But I think with Ray's now, and maybe mine will become like that after I'm gone. Maybe I'll say, oh, have you got a banana? Oh, you lucky. You know, I don't know what will actually happen, but it seems to be a human nature that we treasure more as the time goes by from when the thing was originated until, oh, now that Ray's dead, oh, you know, the value goes up. And whether one keeps it for the financial value or whether one keeps it for a reminder of this process mm-hmm. of exchange, free exchange, where nobody's charging money for their works. I'm seeing something over there in this other building that's really fascinating to me, and I can't tell what it is. The left end, and there's something. Is it a printing press or something?
Well, just directly across, it's a gym.
People are on exercise machine. Okay, I could just see this.
It's people on a treadmill, and this floor below us is dance studios, so we can see people dancing.
Oh, cool. Okay, thank you for the. I could just see this thing, and I couldn't make out what the heck it was. I went for thinking it was a printing press.
Yeah, we can watch the people working out.
Yeah. So that's my take on mm-hmm. how things transform from a living process to a financially mm. viable object mm-hmm. instead of the back and forth. The back and forth is gone when the person's gone. Mm-hmm. So then you have these mementos or, you know, whatever. And when it's a family album, I mean, it still has value to the family. Mm-hmm. Now, whether, you know, the mail art has value to the art, mm-hmm. apparently, I think it does. I mean, especially if you look at Ray as an example, mm-hmm. and I'm hoping that I get to be just as valuable as Ray at some point. You know, it's not that I did things for that point of view, but in retrospect, you know, here's my record.
Mm-hmm. And what is it like for you to look back on all of this work, things like, does it, looking at it now, after these years, looking at these like banana rags,
I see the evolution of my skills as a graphic person. Yeah. You know, from these very early ones,
yeah.
the hand lettered.
Yeah.
There's one more that's all hand lettered.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones when I was the townful, sometimes
yes.
these ones. I mean, if I hadn't progressed,
yeah.
I would be embarrassed.
Yeah.
However.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I started in graphic design,
mm-hmm.
and you know, hand lettered. I'd say, see, I progressed to typewritten,
yeah.
or maybe those were just newspaper clippings.
It's so labor intensive to do all those handwritten
mm-hmm.
things. Yeah.
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 But that was my way of communicating
mm-hmm.
in when I was doing the town fool.
Yeah.
But it evolved, and I think I'm very pleased to see that I progressed
mm-hmm.
as a result of doing it, rather than saying, oh, I can't do that because, you know, whatever. It's
yeah.
I'm not good enough. At the time, this was fine by me.
Mm-hmm.
I was quite happy with it, and now I look at it and think, well, it's a record of where I started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I did at university do art major, but I was with Penny Gouldstone, who taught batik work.
Okay.
And I have few examples of my batik work, because I did do it after I was out of the university,
mm-hmm.
but it was too crafty, and it was very time-consuming and not a great value. You know,
mm-hmm.
you could spend a lot of time on a piece of fabric,
mm-hmm.
but people would say, you know, like, you want $250 for a piece of fabric? I'm sorry. You know, even though they might realize that it's a time-consuming process.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved away from that because
mm-hmm.
it, well, first of all, I wasn't prepared. I was
mm-hmm.
dying in my instructor's vats. She would get in touch with me after I'd gone out of UBC.
Mm-hmm.
She would get in touch. She knew I was doing it, working with her. And when she had a new dye vat of the indigo, she'd call me
okay.
and say, bring your fabric now, because I've got a fresh batch.
Okay.
Right? So that was one of my artistic beginnings. And the other was painting with Herbert Siebner, was a Victoria artist, German refugee, I guess, and when I was 16, my parents were trying to get me on the straight and narrow, and although they didn't think art was a straight and narrow path, they realized that it was something that I was interested in doing,
mm.
and therefore they were prepared to support me to do that rather than have me chasing around with the young men.
Mm-hmm. One of the the stamps that I really like, actually this one, these
iTax books.
iTax book stamps, sort of as a way of protesting the book tax. For you also, I mean, there's also like a political aspect to your...
But
to your
this was also a paid job.
Mm-hmm. Okay, was it?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it was Firefly, Firefly Books.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it because of many things, but it was one of... I think most of the stamp editions, people paid me to produce the stamps.
Okay.
I wasn't in a position to do it. It was, and in fact, it's through production of stamps for other people that I paid off my mortgage over, you know, a period of 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved that edition. I just thought that was a brilliant thing, and I loved circulating them.
We have copies of the stamps here as well. Yeah, they're right here.
Great.
Yeah,
Firefly Books design, basically. Mm-hmm. I just produced it for them. But the fact that they had heard about this as a possibility, and I don't know how that connection happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I obviously had my own PR material, which I sent out to whomever I thought might be interested, and maybe I sent them something, but I think they found out about me some without me finding out about them first.
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine there must not be very many people who have a perforator.
No, there's not very many people. And the ones that do have them are not motorized. Mine is actually motorized, so I was able to produce editions of 5,000 copies or 1,000 copies or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the artists that do stamps have the line perforator, which is a really antique device. My machine was made in 1917, my rotary, and it had a motor added to it at a certain point, and I don't know when that happened, but it's an electric motor that they built a platform off the body of the machine and have the electric motor. Prior to that, it had been, what do you know about belt driven in factories?
Yes.
So they had one power source, and when they wanted to use that machine, they'd hook it up to the power source, and then this belt would go and the machine would roll.
Okay.
Whereas with mine, I had the motor right on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took a while to get them lined up properly, you know, jiggling the wheels and moving them and tightening them and so on, but eventually. And then I would just stand there, and I'd have a stack of them. And it's all paper handling, too. I learned lots of tricks. You fan the paper out, and then you push, like, three or four sheets at a time through the machine. Four times, each sheet, because I didn't have enough pins to do the whole thing at once.
Oh, my goodness.
Hello. Hello, hello.
So
I don't think,
nice meeting you.
Likewise.
I'm going to leave you guys alone.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm going back outside.
Ah, oui.
I'm just getting rid of this box here.
Mais est-ce que tu as besoin d'aide? Parce qu'Hélène est là pour t'aider à monter des choses.
Non, tout est là.
Tout est là? Okay.
C'est mon fils m'a laissé ici.
Okay.
Puis, mais I'll be back in an hour.
Okay.
Okay.
I think this has all been really. Thank you so much for your time.
Right. Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah.
We didn't talk much about Weil.
Yeah, actually, yeah. If you do want to talk about Weil, that was one of my questions about how you began publishing Weil, because I find it really interesting. Just about the, from what I understand, you started Weil after File magazine sort of
poo-pooed
male art.
Mm-hmm.
So was this your way of sort of like bringing it back?
In a way,
yeah.
It was definitely a reaction, and but it was also the perfect, I mean, other male artists had done things like Pyle, or there were other imitations of Life File magazine.
Yeah. And did you still have, like, what was your relationship with General Idea? And what was their reaction to Weil?
They subscribed. When I was in San Francisco, we had exchanges. So I'd imagine that my issues are in their archive, which of course is now in the National Gallery. And I don't know whether they thought I was, you know, because I didn't know them well enough.
Yeah.
I visited General Idea a couple of times when I was in Toronto, and they did subscribe. So, and I remember one of my shipments was confiscated by the to them was confiscated by the morality squad and whatever you call it, you know, the postal inspection people.
Okay.
But I think there was some mutual respect I felt from them.
But I just have one last question for you, just in sort of in general. What do you hope that people take away most from your art practice?
That they would get inspired to do some creative work themselves. I think, aside from documenting what I do myself, because I definitely, you know, that's definitely part of establishing that I exist. But the other part of my work has always been about engaging people. And, you know, they say, oh, I can't do that, I'm not an artist. And I say, yeah, well, you'd be surprised. Because it's self-negation. And that's not a healthy, and that's what our culture intentionally does to most of us. Like, the professional is so valued and worshipped that you don't dare go into their territory because you wouldn't be as good as them. Well, of course you're not going to be as good as them if you don't ever try, if you don't ever do it.
I think, it helps so many people back thinking that they have to create a masterpiece.
Yeah. And so that's always been, I mean, that's the teacher in me from, you know, why I got into teaching in the first place. And I don't really do much of it now because I'm sort of, I've done it and I've got all this material, and now I'm really, what I'd like to do is see it preserved. And I have a lot, and I don't know if there's any institution that's going to be interested in taking it all. And so then comes the question for me was, okay, how do I divvy it out? How do I divide it? And I don't know. I haven't come up with with an answer to that, whether it's just the old, you know, stuff from the 70s or are there particular artists whose work that I would show as an example? I don't know, but I do know that I'm very conscious of my age, and I think how long, I mean, that's partly why I decided to stop doing the stamp editions, because I thought, am I going to want to be doing this into my 80s? I don't think so. And because there, even though I was familiar with the whole process, there was always tension involved in, you know, getting it right, and costly mistakes, you know, perforating off. You know, it's just, it's a very focused activity. And so I guess always the bottom line was, you can do it. And here's how, and I can give you this invitation and, you know, project to do, like, what are your banana stories, for example? You know, it's so easy because we all have them. If you start looking at your family history, when did you first remember about bananas? And, you know, that's also the parallel with monkeys, who are very frank about, you know, I mean, it's very down to earth is the whole banana thing. So I don't know, I've lost my train of thought.
I think that sums it up really well. And I think from what I see, I think even your work in an archive, in a collection, having it, like, it gives it another life, and it gives it another exposure to people. And so I think that your work has the power to still keep people engaged and inspire people to see that, like, oh wow, this is something that is that I can do too, and that it makes, you know, inspires.
I hope so.